what we're seeing today in the Middle East and what we're seeing in Ukraine is that there's an idea that coercive power is going to work. So it can break down into absolute destruction. And, you know, people do that in their personal relationships too. If they can't move, they will destroy each other in some conflict.
We are Humble Mind, a social learning community with an insatiable curiosity for conversations and connections that matter. This podcast is where we get to speak with other Humble Minds. And if you're a member of our community, you get to join our recording live, just like Jen and Maura Danny. You also get access to early releases of new clips on our platform, our weekly newsletter, content replays, community courses from previous sessions, as well as an invitation to join our weekly live group meetup. So check out join.humblemind.co for more. We often think of negotiation as something that takes place in a boardroom, in front of a hard-nosed salesman at a car lot, or any kind of other contract-centered situation. But in reality, we are negotiating every time we are asking for something that we need or something that we want. So to become a better negotiator, you've got to learn how to work with incentives, unpredictability, and of course also be a keen student of human nature. And luckily, we have someone like that with us today who ticks all those boxes. So Karen Walsh is the author of a book called Quantum Negotiation, The Art of Getting What You Need, as well as a coach at Implied Improv for Negotiators. She also holds a PhD in International Relations from the University of Wisconsin. She's an emeritus professor at the Thunderbird School of Global Management. What an amazing name for a school. And over the last 30 years, she's helped leaders and professionals develop the mindset and the skills to negotiate effectively in the form of workshops, courses, books on negotiation, on collaboration, influence, inclusion, using practices and principles of quantum negotiation and implied improvisation. The little boy inside of me is just jumping up and down because this is really the kind of stuff that Humble Mind conversations are made up of. So I'm really excited about today. Thank you for joining us, Karen.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here and to connect with your community. It's wonderful. Thank you, Alex.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Well, this is what it's all about. So there's so much to get into, but I suppose maybe to kind of kick it off with some basic definitions and understanding how you see these big topics, maybe just to kick off just with negotiation itself. What does it mean to you, and why did you, you know, eventually turn this into a career for yourself? How did you do that, and what sparked it all for you when it comes to negotiation?
Well, I'll start with the basic definition, which I learned in graduate school, because I always thought of it as something so overwhelming, there's no way we can put terms to it. And what I discovered was that negotiation is an event or a means of getting what we need from others. And what does that mean? Well, whenever I'm trying to create something new, I'm working with someone to create something new, or if I'm sharing a limited resource, or if I'm problem solving with someone. I'm in a negotiation and I need to be able to work with another to get what I need. And this field started out for me way back when I was a kid. I was always interested in social justice. I didn't know what that was at the time. And when I was an undergrad, I just kept taking courses on social change and development. And then when it became time to think about the next step, I was working in Honduras at a scuba diving resort. And this was a time when the civil wars were taking place in Latin America. And at our resort, we had a lot of people who were working in the civil war, either government agencies or the CIA or leaders from NGOs all over the world. And I became very interested in why was the US involved in Latin American politics. And the ambassador to the US at the time said, you should go to graduate school. And I decided that I wanted to study the field of power. And what I realized when I started that study is that egoism or self-interest is the fundamental foundation in international relations. We must protect ourselves. Egoism is functional and rational. And then I came into the world of social psychology, that it's not the limited resources per se that creates conflict, it's our perceptions of it. And then I went into the whole world of international relations, of coordination, collaboration in international organizations. So in that world, it became, how do we move not from military conflict, but to diplomacy and negotiation? And then I had a chance to teach at this graduate school that really works only with international managers, those who were going to go work in that world. And I was asked to teach negotiation and diplomacy for people who would be going into business internationally. So that's, it wasn't a grand design, a grand theory. It just morphed into this really exciting career. And I like your name of your group, Humble Minds, because I'm completely humbled by this field. I still have so much to learn. I still feel like a baby student. And I just think it's just so interesting when we think about power and conflict and how do we use our behavior to manage conflict and to problem solve and to create new things with each other. It's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose there's also, which I'm sure you're keenly aware of, there's a kind of a dark side to that as well. You know, you mentioned the kind of the need to exercise or demonstrate power and posture that power, which obviously, you know, throughout history for thousands of years has had its moments of showing us a very ugly side of what is possible and what we can do. You know, we absolutely destroy each other, you know, when we don't get what we want. However, when we're able to communicate and to negotiate and compromise, I suppose, is the real word underneath all of that, then right, we can avoid that. We can avoid the suffering and the endless wars and everything else that still, unfortunately, seems to preoccupy us, even in 21st century right, humanity. So maybe we can talk a bit about compromise in the role of negotiation. Is that something that you've kind of seen as a sort of a force at work many times? I remember reading somewhere or hearing somewhere that, you know, normally in a negotiation, when there's both sides trying to get, you know, what they want, when there's compromise, it means that everyone has to kind of, you know, settle for something that they don't really want to give away. But that normally means that that's the way to do it. That's the way to get it done. Is that a view you take as well, or do you have a different way of seeing that?
Well, I love that. We could talk for hours about this topic, because that is one of the means of managing conflict. And I don't know if any of you are aware of the work, it's called the Thomas Kilman assessment, where we actually do an assessment to find out what our general tendency is. And along that continuum of power is that we can completely accommodate to another, which is in my world of self-interest, I look at that as altruism. We can completely give up the sense of self for the other. And on the other end of the continuum is coercion, power over another, which is that I use all of my skills to make you, what they call power in a world of political science, is I can make you do something you would not necessarily do through manipulation, coercion. And then somewhere in the middle, we have compromise, which is we all give up something. And then there's also something called collaboration. And that's the world that I really went down into, which is really the world of quantum, which is we both can get what we need. And that requires a commitment to the relationship. So when people are coming up with their negotiation strategy, the first thing that's assessed, whether we do it consciously or not, is does the relationship matter? And I've asked this question all over the world. Does the relationship you're in right now matter? Therefore, what type of negotiation strategy do you want? And sometimes with somebody who's very vulnerable, often we will use accommodation. We will just give in and just give in because it's so important for the relationship. In other cases, the relationship doesn't matter. And this is why you see in the world of finance, it's all transactional. It doesn't, the relationship itself doesn't matter. However, in that middle range, we often have relationships that do matter. and when it really is an important, and I would say a quantum relationship. We spend a lot of time then on the front end preparing to find ways, where do we in that quantum space have an ability to all of us get what we need? However, if time is short and the relationship isn't that meaningful, you can compromise. And then we move on. Everybody gets something of what they need. So does that make sense to you that it's an analysis of if whether the relationship works, then we use power over or we use power with?
Yeah, absolutely. And just seeing the different aspects of how those relationships play out through the lens of either compromise or coercion or collaboration, which are really interesting sort of avenues of where it's possible to take it.
Right.
I want to be able to, provide the opportunity to also just define what we mean when we're talking about quantum and the quantum world, because it's one of those things that I think quite undeservedly, very quickly gets pigeonholed into the woo-woo side of things.
Right.
Which I think is not fair, right. I think it's a good way to just sort of understand what do you mean by quantum? And I suppose also what is the quantum part add when it comes to this realm, when it comes to negotiation?
Well, there again, we could talk for hours. And I have been a student of quantum physics. And while I was learning about that field, I learned about the larger paradigm shift that happened in physics, which was to go from the Newtonian world where everything is linear and you actually plan and strategize in a linear way. And what I found, the paradigm shift in physics was that it's not necessarily very random, it's not very predictable. That in fact, in the quantum field, it's extremely unpredictable. And we actually can't really harness it unless we understand what the intention is. And then it moved into psychology, is that with our intention and what we're learning about neuroscience is that with intention, we can actually move together into some unknown space and create something completely new and solve problems in the most creative ways when we align our intentions together and move into that space. That's it's very, very layman's definition of it. But moving from cause and effect, like how we used to sit in negotiation and plan our strategy, this move, this counter move, this counter move, that counter move. Now we actually spend time on the front end, getting ourselves in alignment so we can move into that quantum infinite possibilities when we start to get to solutions. And it works because I've seen it many, many times, and I know you've seen it many times as well. But now there's a way to define it, which I found was interesting. Now we can borrow some of the language and science from that field and from the field of neuroscience.
Yeah, it's so fascinating.
Isn't it?
Going into it, I also have kind of dipped my head into a couple of books and many hours of just understanding, at the physics level, what it is, quantum physics, and understanding all of the different principles and, the last century of progress on that. And it is really fascinating. I think it's also good that you've kind of qualified the definition using some of the language, in a considered way, because I think it's always, people often kind of look at it and want to ridicule the use of quantum in any other field other than if we're talking about Einstein and Niels Bohr, right? But if we're looking at the models of how quantum physics perhaps was, some of the discoveries were made, the kind of the thinking and the intentions behind that and how those thoughts were arrived at, I think is a good way to see, well, this is, we're using that same model, but, in this applied sense. Which makes it make sense. And also, I love what you said about the, the non-linearity and the need for intention to be present, to be an active participant, I suppose, in the quantum physics sense, the effect of an observer, right?
Right.
An observer helps to realize the situation in front of you. So are you able to give me a sort of an analogy or an anecdote or some kind of story where you've seen this kind of effect at work and successfully at work in the negotiation space, in some kind of negotiation, maybe even you were part of it, maybe buying your house or something like that, who knows? But something where, that kind of modality actually played a measurable role.
I wish I could share you all the beautiful stories, but there is one that comes to mind. And part of my quantum negotiation model is to think, when we do preparation, to think about what is it that I need on the conscious level, on the thinking level, and then what is it that I need on the emotional level? Then, in terms of socially or behaviorally, what do I need? And then what do I need physically? So I call it the five human dimensions in preparation. And how do I think? How am I going to behave? How am I going to feel? What are some of the physical demands on me, because I'm tired or something is, I'm in pain. And then the last is my spiritual dimension. So I set that up as a framework because I use this in the coaching if I'm working with somebody who's really stuck in a negotiation. So I'll tell you a story about Lewis. Is someone who was born in the UK and then he moved to Australia, but he was working for a UK company. And he was working with a South Korean company. And they had, he is the buyer, and the South Korean contact is the seller. And they had been in negotiations for years on this supply that they needed. And Lewis came and we talked about how does he get through this roadblock that he's in. And we started with all of his whole strategy, sort of what is he thinking, what's his strategy. And he had a very linear kind of strategy, counter offer, all that stuff, and it wasn't working. Then he started looking at how he really wanted to show up, and he said he always planned to be cooperative, but when he got there in person, he would always move to defense. And he got very aggressive and he didn't like that kind of behavior. And then we looked at emotionally, how is he feeling? And he said he's really afraid because he needs this. His job is on the line if he doesn't get this deal done, and he's running out of time and money. And then we looked at physically. He said that he just never sleeps. He drinks too much coffee. He's just angry all the time. He doesn't exercise anymore. So we looked at that. And then finally, we went to the spiritual dimension. And I said, what is the thing that is driving your sense of purpose? Something bigger than yourself that this negotiation represents. And he really thought about it. And he said, what's really the core is that I care a lot about my family and my son. And I want my son to have a good life. And I may not be able to offer that to him. I grew up very poor. So my purpose is that I want to be able to provide for my family and my son. And he just settled into that and just realized that he was becoming very aggressive ultimately because he was afraid. So we started looking at how can he think of the world as more abundant? How can he think of his counterpart in the same dimension? So he went back to Korea and he restarted. And he spent some time exploring these human dimensions with his counterpart. And he and the counterpart, the South Korean man, discovered they were very similar. They had come from really poor backgrounds. They both had sons that they were concerned about. And both of them were in a very scary spot with their companies in terms they needed to make this happen. So they moved into the quantum space, basically. And they actually found a really creative solution that they both won. And to this day, they're still friends, even beyond the contract itself, that they really went into this quantum space and found such infinite possibilities to work with each other. And they went away feeling much more satisfied than just compromising in that particular case.
And that's a great example of, I suppose, a successful negotiation without the need for compromise or conflict or coercion in
Yeah,
some
but it
way.
took a lot of, and this is why we call it quantum too, that the more you anchor with yourself, remember the paradox in quantum? There's always a paradox. The more you really know yourself, the more you can actually stand next to another and understand their point of view. Neuroscience tells us that too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So how would you part of sort of some of your work as well is around influence. And we on the just on the previous podcast, we had someone called Dominic Wilhelm to talk about influence and specifically about trust. You know, all of these wonderful human massive human topics. And so one of the big things that he said is that influence without trust is manipulation, which, you know, makes sense. You know, it's a bumper sticker, you know, kind of statement, makes sense. So
Right.
how can we think of negotiation as not being manipulation? No, we might not necessarily want to directly harm somebody else or manipulate someone, you know, just because we want to be vindictive, but
Right.
we are seeking to get what we want. So is there a kind of an ethical or moral boundary or some kind of thinking you put into it around when does it become manipulation? And is that manipulation justifiable because I need to get what I want?
Right. So it goes back to our grid around the relationship. If the relationship really matters, and something I always think that the more important the stakes are, the more important the relationship is. So in that case, what I like to look at then, and that's why the work in behavioral science and neuroscience is very interesting, because if we can engage and connect with each other's nervous system in a positive way, then we can engage with each other. I don't even have to work at influencing you, because you are really committed to engaging in this relationship. And you have a lot of self-interest at stake. I have a lot at stake. I don't deny your interests, but we creatively find a way to get both of us to meet those interests. If the relationship doesn't matter and you don't have the time to go into that level of engagement, then you use influence. You learn how much that they want something. And then you really spend a lot of time working on what are their needs and then let them accomplish those needs or use their style. You know how the neuro-linguistic programming, we can build more trust if we connect with their pace or their whatever their behavior is.
That's something that another kind of big public proponent of negotiation, Chris Voss. I'm sure you've heard of him, and he's all over
Yeah,
YouTube
we've been at
nowadays.
conferences together. Yes.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah, straight talking New Yorker,
Right.
and he talks a lot about that. Those kind of at that tactical level where you can mirror somebody else. He talks
Yeah.
about labeling as well. You know,
Right.
that's this, and kind of being able to almost sort of create this sort of language, this kind of, you know, line of communication with somebody else where there's a degree of trust upon which
Right.
everything else happens. He also talks about tone of voice as well. Maybe you can, you know, have you found any kind of, you know, any of those, I suppose you can call them tactics or tactical kind of, you know, techniques or methods useful? Are there any that come to mind for you that maybe you use or you've seen used effectively?
That's so perfect because it opens up that whole world of cross-cultural negotiation, right? Because those tactics or those techniques that you just talked about are the same ones we use in cross-cultural communication or negotiation. So I have found that the absolute best tactic is first to know what your cultural preferences are. And I would work with so many executives and students, and all they wanted to do was, how do I negotiate with the Chinese? The first step is, what are my cultural preferences? They're not right or wrong. And then, how do I style shift? How do I code shift when I'm working with someone so I can build that rapport, just like you were talking about? I can build rapport, and then it's called matching, mirroring, pacing, and then leading. Then you can lead. It's really founded on hypnosis. If we can get the conscious mind to slow down, then at the subconscious mind, we feel like I can trust you, then we can actually lead in that situation. So I'll give you an example then of how I've used it, that I grew up in Wisconsin, northern US, and we had a commitment to fluid or to fixed time. When you say you're going to be someplace on time, you are on time because it represents respect, right? And then I moved to Honduras and everything was fluid time. And I was a manager of a resort and I just had so much stress. And I didn't know what culture shock was at the time. So I was really depressed. I had the honeymoon period. I was so happy I was there. And then things weren't working. It's like I wasn't respected in any way. And I realized then that it was fluid time. Mañana doesn't mean tomorrow. So then I learned to style shift. And then I learned to actually love fluid time. It's like, I wish we all could live fluid time. Things will work out. Mm. So then time goes on. And then I'm a professor. And I was on a trip with students to Dubai. And I had a friend there, a Lebanese professor, who said they would like to have you on a radio show at Media City. So he picked me up at the hotel. And first of all, he was late picking me up. And then he said, let's just have some tea first. So I had to calm my nervous system down. As fluid time as I thought I was still very fixed time. So we had tea and we chit-chatted and then we got in the car and then he couldn't find Media City. He thought he knew where it was. I was just panicking inside because I did not want to be, it's a radio show.
Yeah.
We get to the radio show and the host was playing music and doing some other show. And she just said, hello. And then we just started. And I just learned so much from that is that deep, deep acculturation I got about time is still very hard for me. When I'm in a fluid time situation, I have to do a lot of prep. So the technique is, I remember I had to put my feet on the floor and I had to keep breathing. And just remember, my relationship with these people is more important than me getting there on time.
Right.
So the technique is I know I'm a very fixed time person and I can relax in fluid time when the relationship requires this.
Yeah. and I mean, that's a great example of something that I think anyone can relate to whenever they've experienced or even been on the receiving end of some kind of culture shock, whether it's someone's right. accent or the way right. they eat or, you know, silly stuff, you know, just differences right. in the way we all are. But at the same time, it does seem to, you know, really irritate us in the way that we, you know, we're challenged by these norms. There's a resistance mm-hmm. there and we are not willing to put that down. You know, if anything, it's not so much about, you know, our first reaction is not, why am I so unfluid with time? It's rather, why are all these people not paying attention to the time?
Exactly.
You know, it's everyone else's fault, which is funny.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why I love the work in neuroscience now. It's not even about just brain science. It's about the science of our nervous systems. Mm. And when we are unconscious of our own preferences, we will tend to be extremely defensive and irritable and coercive with others. Just like you said, it's something normal in our human nervous system. Like you said, you just move towards saying somebody else is to blame. Mm. But all our practices of really knowing who we are, we discover that they have a preference and I have a preference, neither is wrong. And we actually do a meta negotiation that we actually find a way to find a pace that works for us because we are unique. Our relationship is unique.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious on your views about selling, because a good friend of mine and an amazing, outstanding coach as well, who's been on Humble Mind before, his name is Mike Irving. He talks about the fact that whatever you're doing in life, whatever situation you're in, you are in some form or some process of selling, whether that's, you know, arguing with your partner what to watch on Netflix, or if you're busy closing a $1 million deal, it's the same sort of, you know, roughly the same human process at play. Are there any interesting parallels or relationships between negotiation and selling successfully? You know, I suppose it is still about getting what you want, getting what you need, but yeah, just curious around your thoughts around sales and what makes people successful when they're in a selling position.
He's so right about all of that. Exactly. And every one of those sales are either about creating something new, solving a particular problem. A buyer has a problem, a seller has a problem, and they're working with limited resources, limited time, limited budget, whatever it might be. So it's all selling. We're all out there selling for what we need ultimately. And where the relationship is, just like he's talking about in sales, again, does the relationship matter? And this is what often happens with executives that I work with in large companies, because they get standard contracts. And a lot of us know when you go to an auto dealer, they have standard contracts. And part of our job then in selling is, do they have the monopoly or not? And what do we mean by that? I always look at every sale, every negotiation is a leverage equation. Who has more leverage? So if there's very few car dealers, let's say, very few, then the dealer has the leverage. So then we have to go more toward accommodation, right? However, if there's a lot of dealers and you have a lot of options as the buyer, your leverage goes up. You have almost like 80% of the leverage, they have 20. So there's a lot of room then you could get to compromise in there. So again, it comes back to a seller knowing what their leverage equation is. And what I like the most about negotiation is, before we even begin, is to ask somebody, what do you think the leverage equation is? And ironically, almost everybody starts out with a lower sense of their leverage. And the more we work on it, we find out, your leverage is actually pretty high. You could potentially be 50-50 or even more. So that means if you have an interest in developing a relationship, take the lead on building a collaborative, engaging negotiation. But if it's a standard contract and your seller just can't move from that, then we learn to compromise. That's tough, because we wish everyone we had more leverage. I wish I had the leverage all the time, but I don't.
I find leverage fascinating, just the concept, because it's, I don't think a lot of people kind of get it, or maybe not get it, or once it's explained it makes sense, but rather I don't think we pay enough attention to what it is and what kind of impact it has on our lives all the time, every day, right? Where you I'm reading a book by someone called Naval Ravikant at the moment, who's a who's an angel investor, but he's also a sort of a philosopher, modern day philosopher, and he talks a lot about leverage and whatever you do in life. He'll often say, well, if you're going to build something, try and build it either with the leverage of media or code, because if you've got a brand and you've got a channel, you've got the ability to talk to, millions of people, that's leverage. That's a channel of leverage. I can put the same message out, and instead of one person listening to it, 10 million people can hear it, and it doesn't include any more effort from my side. With code, it's about building something, a platform, a software system that allows the same kind of thing to happen. It also seems to me maybe then that the idea of leverage in a negotiation setting needs to kind of be something that is kept a secret, or is kept kind of to, to your advantage. Because if I was to, maybe I didn't understand you earlier when you said, what is, when you start the conversation, what is the leverage equation between us? In my mind, if I was to start a negotiation like that and get the other person to really think, what are the cards on the table, then maybe I'm losing an advantage by drawing attention to that. It's, is there a different way to think about it? Like, does that make sense?
I love that. Exactly. And we could talk for hours about this too, because I love this area, because it involves both tangible interests and needs and resources. And it also, more importantly, which I have found in almost every negotiation I've been involved in and I've worked with others, there's invisible. Now, go back to your example of brand, right? So you can have a very visible element that you're producing on brand, but then there's a whole world of invisible. And invisible could be an emotional sense of connection, an emotional sense of recognition. those kind of internal needs and invisible, like, I just want respect. And you hear this many times, that somebody might have the best brand, might have the best of everything, but yet the participant or the customer comes in and they just feel like they've never been listened to, that they've never been even recognized or legitimized. And those invisible, that kind of invisible leverage, that's why I don't like to think of leverage as a nasty thing. It's always including visible and invisible assets that you have and that they have. And I think recognition and respect are overlooked as a resource that we can create, an invisible, tangible interest that we can pay more attention to. And you may never have to say it visibly or verbally. Your seller or your buyer can feel, you know, I can tell this is going to be a transactional, coercive situation.
Yeah, when someone rocks up at the door with the vacuum cleaner and, you know, you already know there's something going on here, and I want no part of it. You know, let's stop.
Unless you really needed a vacuum cleaner that day, you would think, exactly. Wow, what timing is that?
Something else that came up in some of the reading and that I was doing on you was just this idea of challenging your own assumptions. How do we do that? How can you challenge your own assumptions? It seems to me like it's probably quite a difficult thing to do if you're just starting out, because sometimes you might not even know what your assumptions are.
Exactly.
So how can you recognize them? How can you start to change them?
Well, this is why I love the world of personal development and professional development, and why I think the world of coaching and kind of peer groups are so important, is that it gives you a chance to really understand what are some of those triggers. Like I said, with the cultural orientations, that one of the things we would use often to get through this rather quickly would be to take an assessment like the Thomas Kilman assessment to find out I am always an accommodator, let's say, then how do I learn to do these other things? Because we need to know how to do all of those things. The other is on the cultural dimensions. We would take an assessment called the cultural orientations assessment. And what I found is, like, for example, going back to my time, I found that I was very high on the continuum of fixed time. So I had to question my assumptions that, you know, that waiter in my dining room when I was working in Honduras is not stupid. He's a fluid time person. And I then had to change my assumption that fluid time is not stupid. Fluid time has real value. And I learned then to style shift to him, but I had to manage my assumptions first. And they're generally negative, right?
Right.
He was dumb. Actually, I was dumb because I didn't understand the cultural context I was working in. So that's an example how we would question our own assumptions. And that's why this is interesting in neuroscience, is that these judgment flashes, they are like microseconds of judgment. And then it changes your whole nervous system. And our intuition just says, you know, something's not right here. And I don't know if you talked to Chris Voss about just facial expressions. Our bodies can pick up if somebody's not smiling with their eyes.
Yes.
That somebody can be smiling at you, but the nervous system knows that that's a fake smile. There's something underneath that. There's something in a microsecond our nervous system can pick up, because it's a common theme that a person who is really genuine and smiling will have a little crinkle in their eyes. And if they're not, you'll just see something kind of hard on the mouth. Just examples like that.
Yeah.
So we question our assumptions. And then the other is, we also would say, well, why is he not, you know, moving on the eyes? Well, then we need to find out more research. Maybe he had an accident and he doesn't have facial expressions. I mean, that's an extreme example,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. And
we don't like to question our assumptions.
Well,
Jen?
that was going to be my next question. Why? I mean, why don't why? Why is that? Why is it so? I mean, maybe it's kind of obvious, but why is it so hard to do that? You know, is it just down to our evolutionary wiring? You know, are we just, you know, did you know, a million years ago, did we depend on that exact instinct to help to save us from predators and, you know, massive landslides? Like, where does that come from? Why is it hard to do that, to change those things?
Yeah. Well, I really believe, just like we're finding in the neuroscience and nervous system and the brain literature, is that, yes, we are hardwired to defend ourselves and to defend our way. And that works really well if we never move beyond our own circle. You probably would never know somebody believes that fluid time is important and it really works if I just stayed in my fixed time environment. But any of us who by experience or your job or something moves you into an environment where someone has different assumptions than you are, you will end up having a lot of discomfort, pain, not making any relationships. Maybe, and this is what I have found a lot working in the global commercial space, is that your company would tell you, you need to get over your irritability and your inability to connect with other people. You need to get a coach. So sometimes it's forced on us, or maybe a partner, or maybe a friend or a family member will say, you need to get some help. Because you cannot build relationships if you're always the center of the universe and your preferences are the only right way to live in the world. And some will never, ever know that there are other assumptions. But the more global we get, the more interconnected we are, we're all finding out how different we are from each other. And we're also finding out when you do your personal development and professional development, you find that we are alike in so many ways because we all have a human nervous system.
Yeah.
And there are certain fundamentals in a human nervous system that require attention, require legitimacy, respect. Just that's why that's such an important element, is that professional and personal development. If you want to experience a fuller, more colorful, interesting world, it's not always easy. And I've had many, many tears, but I've learned and I love it.
Well, on the subject of tears, Jen has just put a question in there. You know, how are you able to then negotiate or work with somebody who does view themselves at the center of the universe and their way is the right way? It's a great question. You know, how can you negotiate with someone who, despite your best efforts, just doesn't want to negotiate or doesn't want to move off their position? Are there some little techniques or practical advice?
Yeah, and I think it's basically a lot like we've just been talking about, is first of all, are you really clear on what you need? And in terms of leverage, is this the only person you're going to get what you need from? So that's why you hear this all the time in negotiation. What is my BATNA first? Before I even start to negotiate or get trapped in a negotiation, I have a best alternative to this agreement, that I have more leverage because I have actually other options out there. I have other options. So we know that I have an option, and I'm going to start addressing what is their self-interest, because I know what mine is. And they wouldn't be there if they didn't have something at stake. What is it? And this is also interesting because I've spent a lot of time studying narcissism. And it is true that 1% of the population have some kind of borderline personality or narcissistic trait that they don't even have the capacity in their brain to have social contact. It is true. However, most of us basically don't even know what our self-interest is. What are we really looking for? And sometimes it's just respect. Sometimes it's just being listened to. So you work through the five dimensions and basically find out what is their self-interest and can I meet them? And then it's almost like we said before, using neuro-linguistic programming, I mirror their pace, then I pace with them, and then I actually start to lead. And ultimately, if you cannot get what you need or even compromise in that situation, this is where some people then have their whole plan worked out, that they will actually move toward coercion. But if the relationship matters, then you completely accommodate or you compromise. If you can't get collaboration and you don't want to coerce, you might just accommodate. But it depends on the nature of the relationship. Mm. I wish I could give a straighter answer on that, Jen. But yeah. I love this field because we all talk about, we all want to collaborate, but for most part, because I don't feel like enough of us do our personal development, that we tend to negotiate with a defensive strategy. Mm. And our way is the right way. My assumptions are the right way. And that's why building trust helps them move off of their right way, because now you've touched on something that they really do need. Mm. And you can help them. You get them to help you solve your problem as well. Sometimes people just want to be helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unbeknownst to themselves. Yeah. And that's
right. And that's the invisible, right? Those are the invisible resources that we tend to forget, especially if somebody gets really hardball with us.
Is there a good moment to know when it's time to walk away? Because we've talked about collaboration, coercion, and the different options that you have.
Right.
But is there a fifth where I can, it's actually not even worth going forward. I'm going to walk away and I'm now going to, put my energy somewhere else. When does that moment happen and how to take that?
I would say on two levels, there's two things that are in place. One is go back to your prep. Go back to your preparation. What is it that you really needed? How did you want this to go? And it didn't go. So you hit a tripwire. I didn't get this, whether it was the process or the outcome. Then I go to my alternative. So one of it, and a lot of it has to do with your ability to be clear and to be prepared at the outset. What did you really need? And here's one way to get what you need. If that doesn't work, then I go to all my alternatives, right? And the second marker is, how do you feel? Again, your nervous system will tell you, this is not going well. I said in the beginning that if I didn't have this completed in a year, I would then end this process, right? And this is one of the things that a lot of people don't like to do before we begin a negotiation, is know how to say no.
Oof.
And those of us who have an accommodation tendency.
Yeah.
And I found that there's been a lot of students I've worked with say at the end of any kind of training we've done, and say, the best thing I learned was I do get to say no. Mm. And it has to do with my reality of my preparation.
The reality.
Not to feel so desperate.
I love that. Beautiful. I'm going to ask some of our members to come off and please come with your questions or your comments. Tolu.
Loved your perspective, Karen. I loved where you were talking about understanding your preferences, your cultural preferences. I thought there was a lot that you said there that was, it was very rich, and there was a lot of, the examples that you gave and stuff. I really, really like that. And I think that this is something that I think having a model that you apply to looking at things like this helps, because a lot of times we kind of wander around what exactly is going on. Why am I feeling a certain way? But I think that having a model to think about, this is my preference, right? Mm-hmm. And how do I make sure that I get comfortable when it's different? Because each of us is going to have situations where we have to stick to what works, what we know, because who we're dealing with has that,
right?
I.e. aligned with our preferences. But we're going to be in situations that are different from our preferences as well. And we need to be able to survive, right? And you talked about, you talked about Asia, and I think you talked about the Middle East as well. And this is, for me, I'm doing stuff in those places and kind of shifting across, so I really enjoyed kind of listening to the thinking and the models that could help to make that
awesome
easier to work with. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And I don't know if you've heard this saying, those of us who have to work across these different cultures, whether they're organizational or family or country, feeling comfortable with feeling uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
And that's how we manage our own nervous system. And I have never, like I gave you my story, I've never been completely confident that I can behave and that I can actually get what I need in a very, very unfamiliar culture. But I have learned to feel comfortable just being uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of life.
It's part of life. And that's why I love the topic you cover, Alex, is that it does require, it's quantum. The more adaptable we can be, the more quantum we can be, the more confident we can be, we have to be so humble that we don't know.
Yes. Yes.
We don't know the answers, right?
Yes.
Or even how to behave here. And that's why we reach out to our fellow negotiator. Just, you know, what is the protocol here? Even little simple questions like that to what is the right protocol that I should have here about greeting? All right. What's been your experience of greetings?
In terms of, greeting people.
Greeting people, shaking hands, kissing, right? Don't touch women.
Right? And just watching for the natural, like what's going to happen next? Am I overdoing it? Yeah.
And that's overdoing
it. Yeah.
Great to talk for hours just about greeting.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you. That was great. I love it.
You are welcome. Thank you.
I think one of the things that struck me most is your story about Lewis and his willingness to move from a very kind of angry, defensive posture to being what sounds like completely vulnerable about where he was on each of those five things and inviting. That took a tremendous amount of courage, I think, because that could have gone a different way. And so that combined with know how to say no and stick to your own values and your own truth, I think, in the face of a negotiation, those are the two biggest gems that you've given me today.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Yeah, isn't it an honor when you see somebody move from that level of desperation and vulnerability and defensiveness to actually what I always call is helping people find their power, actually find that they can claim all the resources they have in themselves and they can lead in a cooperative situation. And that's why I'm a firm believer in coaching or peer groups, because it's not easy. And we all can continue. And that's why I said I'm humbled by this field, because I'm still learning. Just people need so many different kinds of things. I wouldn't even imagine some of the things people actually needed. And I never, ever thought of it.
Yeah.
And if they don't tell you.
It's people dynamics, isn't it? And it's
an
endlessly fascinating area. I wanted to ask you about questions. And asking questions, because that I used to do some sales training and questions is always a massive part of being able to conduct a conversation, you know, get the information you need, build a bond of trust and credibility, asking good questions and phrasing them in the right way. Are there any kind of little tools or good ways of thinking about how to ask questions, you know, in order for you to get the information you need, use it in such a way so that you can ultimately still get what you need to get out of the interaction?
Mm-hmm. Well, the best tool that we have is the preparation tool, which is something that we have in our book, and we can get worksheets on that and everything. But it's basically everything that you've done when you do the interest-based or the principal negotiation strategy. Think of all the interests that everybody has first, and then what positions they might take. My addition to it is doing a prep on the five human dimensions. How am I thinking? Am I thinking scarcity or am I thinking abundance? Am I feeling afraid or am I feeling confident because of my prep? So you do your own prep, and then you have also on the other side of the grid, all of the same questions about the other side. And a lot of us do some research before, but most of the time we come into a negotiation with not even having any understanding about the other side's five human dimensions or their interests and their positions. So I always call prep, you do your individual prep, and then you have a pre-negotiation with each other to explore all of the items on our prep sheet. So the questions are driven by filling in your prep sheet. So you know that you didn't forget about addressing, let's say, what gives them more purpose or meaning, or why is this negotiation so important to them? And then when that grid is complete, which will never be, throughout the negotiation, you're always adding more information in terms of what are some other ways I could appeal to her self-interest or to his self-interest, or do we need to take a break at a certain time? And do I just need to say no to some things and maybe we can repackage? Once you've got everything out, oftentimes you can do some trades and you can package an outcome together. So it's a long answer to I believe preparation matters. And you'll have a lot of questions when you get to the pre-negotiation phase, and then to keep asking and verifying as you go along.
Is there negotiations that don't work, or that rather not so much not work, but get to a standstill or some kind of deadlock? Do you have a theory on how that gets there and why deadlocks emerge, how that happens, and maybe even as a result, how to you know, come out of a deadlock?
Yeah. Well, there again, I wish we had hours and hours, because it's been fun to study deadlocks. And this is why political science is so interesting, is that a lot of political science will focus on the power over strategies first.
Yeah.
Right. And then we'll move to maybe power with. And oftentimes, I mean, there's so many answers to this. It could be a lot of things, but it goes back to your prep. If you cover all of those elements and then you review your behavior and their behavior, because sometimes it's just in your behavior. Sometimes it's just a physical problem. We've seen this where there have been some high level negotiations going on and the parties never got fresh air. There was smoke in the room everywhere. They were eating junk food. They never got any exercise, and they decided to take a break. And they were gone for maybe 2 days and then came back and opened the windows, and they went beyond deadlock. So it could be a lot of things. And it also can be, just like we were talking about before, maybe you just don't have the right fit. And as we're seeing in a lot of actual coercive, destructive power over, what we're seeing today in the Middle East and what we're seeing in Ukraine is that there's an idea that coercive power is going to work.
Yeah.
Right? However, those of us who believe in diplomacy, and there has to be what we call a multi-track diplomacy, a lot going on that we can't see, both on the military level, right? And on the diplomatic level, there's a lot we don't see because these are very sensitive talks. But for the public, the general public likes to see, I want power over.
Yeah.
And we're going to win at the power over on the militaristic side of it. So it can break down into absolute destruction. And, you know, people do that in their personal relationships too. If they can't move, they will destroy each other in some conflict, whether it's, you know, breaking up a partnership or marriage, or we see it all the time. And it's how they think about the relationship going forward. That's why a lot of conflicts, breaking up partnerships or marriages, often go into mediation, because the long-term relationships still does matter. So we are going to mediate and engage with each other to get a final outcome. And in other cases, one or the other party isn't interested. So you go hardball, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And it's all about destruction. And really nobody wins except the lawyers in that.
Oh, good. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Everywhere in the world. It's not just in the US. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Is that true?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't add anything to what you said. Really is. You've really nailed it. And it's the same thing. And I think that having a model as you described of looking at both parties but I think that it helps if both people have that mindset, both sides. Yeah. So this works when you have two people who think broader picture, mm-hmm. long term. How, if we fight, how will this end? Because what happens is if you're a diplomat, if you're a diplomacy type of person and you're with someone who's kind of less mm-hmm. self-aware, mm-hmm. then you get to the point where your diplomacy essentially doesn't help you to be as prepared
right.
as you need to be, right? Yeah. So you go to conflict unprepared, right? Yeah. Because the person's not thinking about the after.
Exactly. And that's what we used to have Commander Rodebaugh come to our classes all the time and talk about negotiating like Chris Voss does with hostage takers.
Yeah.
And he would say we always had to have a best case and a worst case mm-hmm. scenario. So that's why we often look at, like you were saying, Alex, before, if you hit a tripwire, do I move then to coercion or do I move to walk away? Mm-hmm. And because of your prep and the nature of the relationship, you make that choice.
Yeah. Mm. It's like a judgment call, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's also interesting to go back for a moment to negotiation in the political realm, you know, where mm-hmm. you've got nations, and I suppose that's what diplomacy is, right? Diplomacy is political negotiation, you know, in place of war and outright kind of strife. Yeah.
And it takes place in trade. It takes place in social exchanges and education. That's a very rich world right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to see the different elements of or the different styles of negotiation. I'm thinking of kind of the likes of Henry Kissinger, you know, mm-hmm. with his Realpolitik and, you know, that kind of class of diplomats that came in that era, and certainly many more around him.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily only him, where, you know, it's all about making the, you know, getting the deal and being able to kind of have a pragmatic approach to getting what you want instead mm-hmm. of, you know, operating from a place of principles.
Yeah.
Which I suppose if you're looking at, you know, end justifying the means and getting what you mm-hmm. need done, then that's an effective approach, you know, but when it comes to, you know, doing that in personal situations, that's maybe closer to what we were talking about earlier, which is just outright manipulation, right?
Yeah, right. And oftentimes if we know, talking about preferences, if I know my preference is really on collaboration and we really get to that tripwire and say, this isn't working, I may get my partner to then take it to the next level. Because we have people in our sphere who are really good at coercion. And they would be happy to help you.
Well, that's the thing. You know, yeah, you've got your kind of different warriors for different.
Right. Yeah, different those are tools. These are all our extra tools. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And I have to say something to something you said earlier about when both parties are prepared. I actually did a research project on this where I did it with a whole group of students, and we had a form that could quantify the outcome and could quantify the preparation. And we found by numbers, a numerical study, that people who were both prepared and did the collaborative approach got exponentially better results.
Yes.
Quantifiable.
Yes. Yes,
and absolutely. When only one was prepared and the other wasn't, you get a mediocre result.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then if they both weren't prepared, you get a really bad result.
Horrible result. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Preparation is key. But I think that it's the tools for preparation that I think is the magic, you know, I think that's the gold in all this. Like knowing that you need to prepare is one thing, but how do you prepare efficiently and in a structured way that gets right. the outcome. And I think that's where the power of your kind of, you know, that's the value of what you're talking about, is that what are the tools? How do you need yeah. to, how, what do you need to think about these five dimensions,
right?
So you can then apply that in a structured way to get an outcome. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of people think this is soft, that I'm too soft about thinking about negotiation. And I just have to say, from my experience and from the research and from the, your all experiences, it really does matter.
Yes.
You really do get better outcomes and you feel more satisfied also too.
I think even as a topic in academia, we, you know, I'm a finance person and we always look at negotiation and stuff as a soft thing.
Yeah.
But it's one of the most important things in the military and in diplomacy. It cannot be that you can't just become a great negotiator. You have to like learn there's a structure and but a lot of people it's still not enough. I think because again, like negotiation seems to be taking more seriously in high stakes situations.
Yeah.
And so because of that, the average person doesn't really get to, you know, yeah, so this is the problem. I think it's about cascading this to a level where actually negotiation and understanding it is critical to your career, but to your life and happiness.
Your life, right? Exactly.
Yes.
I agree completely. Oh. Now you can see why I love this field so much, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you've given me a huge dimension because even I had I do a lot of negotiating in my work.
Having
the models that I use are quite elementary when I compare it to the kind of stuff that you're talking about. And so I'm like, well, this is kind of, there's a lot that you need to learn. So I think for me, it's a huge eye opener, to be honest.
Awesome. I want to hear your stories, please.
Yes.
I love it. It's great.
For sure. Well, the beauty is that we're all connected now as part of the Humble Mind community. So
awesome.
And I so love what Karen, when she talked about humble and how it's necessary to be humble. And
that's when
I made the connection. I didn't, you know, so it's kind of when I made the connection about how humility actually it's humble mind and that's what helps the problem. And it's true. It's true because when you're humble, you do better deals.
Yeah.
Right?
It's something.
But when you have a chip on your shoulder, then you miss out on the opportunities and stuff. And so absolutely it's
you great. You can get a lot done if you have an open mind and an open heart.
So yes, yes.
When she mentioned that, I definitely did a little.
Did you get it? You got it. Did you? Well, did you give yourself a pat on the back?
Yeah, I was like, yeah,
awesome.
Absolutely. No,
free
it's
product
really
placement.
Good.
Yeah.
Yes. No, it's very, very good. It's very good. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful to have you with us, Karen. And I definitely think we need to have you on with us again. Just certainly to talk about other stuff, but even if we had the same conversation, I think we'd all learn again because there's just so much to it and there's so much meat on the bone here when it comes to understanding, you know, everything we talked about, the value of preparation, the value of challenging assumptions, asking good questions, understanding what causes deadlocks, thinking about leverage, and also what you mentioned about the cultural understanding and the culture shock and how that plays a role in the very assumptions that we need to challenge, I think was fascinating. So really appreciate your time and loved having you with us. And certainly want an opportunity when you can come back.
I would love that. And I will see you on the community site. So Tulu, connect there. Yes. It'd be great.
Yes, sure thing. I sent you a LinkedIn invite already. So.
Oh, good.
Look
Perfect.
At that. Look at that.
Ciao. Okay.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Humble Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're curious to take a look at our community, if you're not a member, you're missing out. Make sure you head to humblemind.co to check out more and to see what we're up to. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next time.